This episode is presented by Forever Cheese.
This week on Meat and Three, we're exploring the culinary wonders of urban New Jersey with a tour through Newark. We speak to Frank Mentisana at Phillips Academy Public Charter School.
This idea of family style and made from scratch lunches continues to be a bit of an anomaly in the city.
We also hear from Gil Speyer from All Points West Distillery.
Newark used to have an incredibly rich beverage alcohol history.
And we'll tour Aero Farms, the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
We're growing using 390 times more productivity than field farming and 95% less water.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network to be amazed at the wonders of Newark. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. At the end of every show, I ask all of my guests, what can listeners do to get involved in a particular issue? And the response, invariably, is A, vote with your wallet, and B, call your elected representative. Well, today, I'm pleased to welcome one such elected official, Congressman Earl Blumenauer, Democratic representative of the 3rd District in Oregon, who has been a longstanding champion of food system reform issues, something that has been all too rare in Congress. Representative Blumenauer, welcome to Eating Matters.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, so the 3rd District is where exactly? Can you just give us a sense of how big of an area you represent, the number of people?
Well, it is most of Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
Starts in Portland's West Hills and goes east to include most of Portland and on to smaller towns, Gresham, and to the top of Mount Hood.
And how long have you been involved in politics? What is your background kind of before you were represented, were elected?
Well, I first became involved in politics as a college student when I helped lead the effort to lower the voting age. I organized and chaired a campaign in Oregon. I testified before the United States Senate on the 18-year-old vote. And 2 years later, I was in the Oregon legislature, which was a terrific experience. And then I subsequently spent time in local government the last 10 years as Portland's Commissioner of Public Works, dealing with transportation and land use and environment.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have spent 22 years in Congress.
Wow. So you're a veteran.
I'm a lifer.
So when and why did you seriously get involved in food system reform issues? I mean, being from an urban area, certainly doesn't seem like it would be a top issue for your district.
Well, actually, people in Portlandia care a lot about food.
True.
It is. There has been a vibrant restaurant scene here in Portland for years. When I was in the Oregon legislature, I was involved with efforts enacting our historic land use planning, which in large measure was designed to protect forest and farmland. In local government, being keenly interested in activities to protect local food sources. Part of our land use challenges was to provide agriculture actually within the urban growth boundary. From the moment I was in Congress, have been deeply concerned with our food and agriculture policy. We just pay too much to the wrong people to grow the wrong food, the mm-hmm. wrong way, in the wrong places. It compounds problems with nutrition and hunger. So it's been an area that I have been involved with for years, and it's something that, as time goes on, I feel more strongly about, that it is so important mm-hmm. to get these policies right in terms of nutrition and health for our citizens and for the future of the planet.
And are you on any ag committees right now?
No. I serve on the Ways and Means Committee in Congress, but that has not stopped me from being involved with developing food and farm policies. Every year I've been in Congress, I've sponsored amendments to try and change some subsidization that I think is misplaced. Mm-hmm. I have strongly supported changing the environmental provisions. The conservation programs really don't effectively promote conservation.
Right.
We have been fighting poor decisions. For instance, what's happened in places like North Carolina with hog lagoons in the aftermath of intense hurricanes that just overflow and poison the land.
Right.
So every year there's been things that have caught my attention that I've worked on.
There's always something.
There is. But it came to a head about 4 years ago when I was reflecting on the difficulty we had with reforming the last Farm Bill. We got some minor provisions in, and we got some, in terms of conservation and nutrition and whatnot. But it just seemed to me that we didn't really have an appropriate vision for what the Farm Bill really should be. And instead, it was dictated by a wide range of people who have a vested interest in the current programs.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the, like, you know, transition to the Farm Bill specifically. I mean, I know that this is something you've been incredibly active on. And I love that you're not on any ag committees, but yet you are so involved. I think that's one of the things I find most refreshing. In addition to the fact that with regards to the Farm Bill, you've said that with its reauthorization, you've said that Americans deserve one that resets spending priorities, promotes healthy food, and provides innovative performance-based solutions to environmental challenges. Now that it is officially passed, how do we do?
I would grade it about a D+.
Okay.
There were some provisions that were in there.
Yep.
We're working a little bit in terms of performance-based environmental areas. There's some things for sustainable agriculture, but basically, the big investments continue to be agriculture from the past. Big commodities, 94% of the support is to a handful of states producing a handful of the commodities, corn, soy, sugar. It shortchanges the majority of states and the overwhelming number of farmers and ranchers. We actually spent a couple of years just going around in Oregon and elsewhere asking people, what would the Farm Bill look like if it was just for you?
Is that your Sing Your Own Farm Bill project?
Yeah, it was great fun. Over 5,000 people helped us with feedback, and we produced a Farm Bill that I was very, very proud of. It had titles in conservation to cut cap and clarify the farm subsidies, nutrition for food waste, the future of farmers, regional food systems, the first animal welfare title. It was great fun to put this together. And I think, modestly, it's a blueprint for where American agriculture needs to go. And I think we're going to be, well, we're starting now because we've got another, in 5 years, we've got another Farm Bill in front of us, and we can do a lot better.
Right. Better start now, because it seems like if history has taught us anything, it takes a while.
Well, and it's important to help people focus on these elements. Most people just don't pay any attention to the Farm Bill. But in fact, it's the most important health bill that this Congress, this last Congress, considered.
Right.
We're subsidizing a diet that makes Americans sick. It's the most important environmental bill. 9% of the greenhouse gases come from agriculture.
Yeah.
And issues of water quality, air quality. So we need to do a better job of engaging people with what the stakes are.
I mean, like, the thing about the farm bill is that it's always been seen as kind of like a special interest bill and parochial. And I mean, how do you work to change the perception of that? How do you engage people? Do you think it's through issues like the environment?
Part of it is to help people understand the vast sweep of the farm bill. The Department of Agriculture is the only department in the federal government that can build a community from the ground up. Housing, economic development, as goes beyond just what happens with food and farm. The notion here that the farm bill is extraordinarily expensive. There's a big battle over whether we have enough money for nutrition, but we are having lavish spending on a crop insurance program that frankly doesn't work for most farmers and ranchers. Oregon, my home state, is a huge agricultural state,
mm-hmm.
but our agricultural base is very, very diverse. And most of the farmers and ranchers can't use the crop insurance program. But that's also true for Florida and California. California, the number one agricultural state in Oregon, in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to do a better job of helping people understand the sweep, what the stakes are, and the fact that we have choices that can make a big difference.
So there's a lot, obviously, entailed in the farm bill, and a lot of people, there have been calls to consider splitting out SNAP from the mm-hmm. overall bill, and that is, we know, mm-hmm. like, what, 80% of the total funding?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Where do you fall on that issue? Where do you fall?
Well,
it's do you think it would be
blessing.
Helpful? Yeah, do you think it would be helpful?
Yeah, having the nutrition elements be a part of the farm bill historically has been a way to unite urban interests, non-farm districts, with the agricultural sector. But too often, I think, people who are deeply concerned about meeting the nutritional needs of poor people allowed themselves to be held hostage. Actually, survey after survey shows that SNAP benefits, you know, food stamps,
mm-hmm.
is much more popular than agricultural subsidies. It's been a mixed bag. I think in the final analysis, it doesn't really make that much difference if we can help people understand what their stakes are in a food and farm bill that meets their needs. Marion Nestle, the great professor at NYU on nutrition,
mm-hmm.
Written, I don't know,
former Florida Eating Matters guest.
I expect so. has a terrific essay entitled "The Farm Bill Drove Me Crazy." A few years back, she realized, although she's been writing about these things for years, she really didn't fully understand the mechanics of the farm bill. So she decided to do what any professor would do to try and understand a subject. She was going to teach a seminar on it. And halfway through, she realized that nobody understood the farm bill. It was hopelessly complex, that people understood things that related to them directly, like the aforementioned crop insurance. There are people who are experts in that, but it didn't go very far. The commodity programs. One year I just tried to spend an entire flight home. I fly home every week from Washington to Portland.
And that's a lot of travel.
About a 6-hour trip. I spent the entire trip trying to understand the dairy program.
Yeah.
And I just ended up with a headache.
Yeah.
It is hopelessly complex. The need to be able to organize. That's why we did our own food and farm program for legislation, which was to be a marker that people could organize around. And I continue to think that is absolutely essential to raise awareness and understanding and have a model piece of legislation that incorporates things that work for most farmers and ranchers rather than intensely for the special interests.
Do you think one of the ways into we know that climate change, there have been a number of reports that have come out recently that have gotten a lot of attention, talking about how dire the situation has become and where we need to go. And it's sort of starting to I think that the majority of Americans believe that climate change is real and it's an issue and it's man-made. So this environmental movement may slowly mm-hmm. be getting some traction. And you are one mm-hmm. of the very few people who make the connection between, the need for the food movement, the food and farm movement, to join forces with the climate movement. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is like a good way in, a good segue to food on board?
Well, absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, we're not going to be able to meet our goals of cutting emissions in half by 2030 and to go to net zero by 2050 unless we address the emissions of agriculture. It's not just 9% of our greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture the way it's currently practiced. It's animals and poor cultivation practices that create these greenhouse gases. Opportunities going forward to actually practice what's termed regenerative agriculture, making it sustainable, being able to do a better job with conservation, to be able to actually capture and sequester carbon, not just reduce the emissions, but actually to be able to reverse it by capturing carbon.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that we can do that will actually improve productivity while it helps us fight climate change. It also expands the group of people who care. The army of activists that are being involved with food and farm policy are very persuasive. One of my favorite battalions in this battle are the celebrity chefs, people who really understand the multifacets of having a sound food and farm policy. And they are voices that really are quite persuasive, but working with students. And frankly, most farmers and ranchers want to be involved in this fashion.
Mm-hmm.
They are shortchanged with the conservation programs. We don't do enough to help them deal with water conservation and to be able to help in their efforts at reducing carbon emissions. And frankly, the agricultural sector is being pounded as a result of climate change. The droughts that we're seeing in the United States, in Australia, I mean, it's driving farmers to despair. Suicides are up.
They're very much feeling the brunt of climate change. There's no doubt. And I think that there's a huge willingness amongst farmers to make mm-hmm. a lot of these changes.
Mm-hmm.
They do, however, need the tools and, assistance mm-hmm. to do so. We're going to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors, but we will continue our conversation with the congressman when we get back.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Forever Cheese sources the highest quality and most unique cheeses and other products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia, and imports them to the United States, many under the Mitika brand. If it's Mitika, it's got to be incredible. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio has plenty more. Hi, I'm Harry Rosenblum, and I'm the host of Feast Your Ears here on HRN. My show explores the world of food through storytelling. Every week, I talk with people inside and outside the food world about how experience has shaped what they eat and cook. You can find Feast Your Ears wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
One of the things I want to talk to you about, you know, we talk about, to your last point, I'm sure you saw this. There were students from the Sunrise Movement who, of course, are very like, you know, they're kind of trying to lead the way on climate change for the next generation. They made the news by confronting Senator Feinstein a few weeks back about her stance on climate change and specifically the new Green Deal. And I mean, she said, and this was a cringeworthy moment for me, but, you know, the exchange was essentially like, you know, the students are asking for her to take action, saying like, you know, that's your duty as a representative official. And she's like, how old are you? And the girl says 16. And she's like, you didn't vote for me. And, you know, I love Senator Feinstein, but that was like an issue where I cringed. Right. And I feel like her press secretary cringed also. But I'm wondering, like, how are you? What are your thoughts on how the government can best address concerns of younger people like this who might not be old enough to vote yet, but will certainly inherit the brunt effects of climate change?
And that's the point. The teenagers today that are not quite yet old enough to vote are the people that are going to be paying the price.
Yeah.
And their energy and enthusiasm, I think, is part of what is necessary. The notion of the Green New Deal is to do something on an order of magnitude of what America did a couple generations ago. With Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, the mobilization to win World War II. In the 30s and into World War II, America did amazing things. We came together. We rescued the economy from the near global collapse. We mobilized the forces to win against the forces of oppression in World War II. We did extraordinary things coming together, and we found the resources, the energy, and the resolve. And that's exactly what we need to do to be able to deal with climate change.
Right.
Now, I helped the folks write the agricultural provisions for the Green New Deal.
Yeah, you're
because that is part of the scope and the urgency, and is entirely within our capacity.
And in all fairness to the senator, I mean, she raised great points. It doesn't have the political capital, and you know, it was just a resolution. It won't pass, but whatever. I mean, I think that it, to me, at least in my opinion, it just represented like a big plan, that it wasn't legislation, but it's like, here's where we need to go. We need something super bold, and this is a start.
Well, and that is frankly what I did with my food and farm bill, what I worked on for several years. Mm-hmm. It, only a small part of that found its way into this farm bill, but we have a template, a model legislation that I think can make a big difference in the next farm bill.
Yeah.
We need to have this sense of urgency. We need to have aspirational efforts. But what I have seen with food and farm policy and dealing with climate is that we're watching minds be changed. We're watching more and more people be engaged. And if we are all doing our job, these are the sorts of things that we can, in fact, do in this decade to be able to meet the objectives of the Green New Deal. It's not hammered into legislation, and nothing's going to pass the Republican Senate and with Trump in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
But we can set the stage. We're working in communities around the country. The 50 largest American metropolitan areas are moving on these policies. States, California has done a great job with their food and farm policy. We're watching this get traction. And when we get a better Senate and a new president, I think these pieces can fall in place if we have our eyes on the bigger picture.
Not to sound like a skeptic, but
a
pessimist.
Be skeptical.
I've been covering these issues for long enough to be pessimistic.
Yeah.
So in thinking about the Green New Deal, right? Like, I just heard an interview with Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee, and I want to talk about his new proposal, a new Manhattan Project for clean energy, which is sort of like a response to the Democrats' Green New Deal. But one of the things that struck me in hearing him talk about his new, you know, this sort of proposed idea is that, you know, he literally said that the new Green Deal focused on, and I quote, cow burps. And I, you know, we all know this is burps is not really what he wanted to say, but it went viral, I think, on Twitter. And like, this was a big soundbite that AOC wants to focus. This legislation is like anti-cow, basically.
It's not true,
but it is true that the meat industry is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas pollutions. And I think it highlighted the fact that there's still a major rift between people don't draw a connection between the two, and they don't want to talk about almost agriculture at all. So how do you work to shift the minds of people who are not close to there yet?
Well, I think the strength that we have is that everybody eats.
Mm-hmm.
And at some level, the majority of Americans understand that the heavily subsidized industrial agricultural model is not serving their interests. We're watching the fragility of family farms and ranchers, where they're going bankrupt, they're being stressed by large producers. But there are better models that are being utilized and gaining adherence in terms of regenerative agriculture. It's a big issue in Iowa right now that people are starting to understand that the industrial agricultural model is shortchanging them. I've reintroduced our Pollinator Protection Act. We're watching huge problems with having pollinators to be able to protect American agriculture. I mean, this is essential for one out of every three forkfuls of food. It's almost $200 billion internationally.
Mm-hmm.
And we're watching the loss of bees. We're watching actually the collapse of insect populations. One quarter of the world's insects could be gone in 10 years. We've already seen massive reductions in Germany, for instance. So these elements that people are seeing are starting to mobilize attention. And the fact that most farmers and ranchers are cheated by the current system. They don't get money for conservation because too much of it is misdirected to large industrial operations and not to smaller scale that could better utilize it and have requirements that they actually protect the environment. This is something that is not pie in the sky. This is something that directly affects the agricultural sector in stress. Most people have great reverence for family farmers and ranchers, and having humane treatment of animals, having better nutrition, dealing with air and water quality. I mean, these are things that are understandable if people will stop and look at it. And that's not something that is unrealistic. And these are the sorts of things that will move us along this path.
Just quickly, can you tell us what is in the proposed Save America's Pollinators Act?
Sure. Well, what we're trying to do is to deal with these neonicotinoids that have been linked to insect deaths, particularly as it relates to bees. They've been banned in Europe.
Can you just tell us what neonicotinoids are, just so our listeners who don't know?
It's a pesticide that has broad applications. We watch, for example, in suburban Portland, a massive bumblebee die-off, and it's linked to the application of these neonicotinoids. It's something that, as I mentioned, the European Union has banned. What my legislation would do is to prohibit its use unless an independent panel of experts determines that it's safe. And by the way, if it's killing bees and other insects, it's probably not too good for human beings either. We've got a tremendous response from the public, and we're working to build on that experience in Europe and the growing awareness to see if we can move that legislation in this Congress.
Okay, so I know that we are a little pressed for time, so I've got a couple more questions, if that's okay with you,
even
though I could chat forever. You're like, no,
fun to talk about.
Time. One of my questions is, in your role leading the House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee, I want to talk about trade and food. More than half of the fresh fruit and almost a third of fresh vegetables in the U.S. now comes from other countries, which I think a lot of people don't realize. And, and this is just expected to continue to grow. And you talk a lot about, you know, the fact that we're not growing the right kind of food in the right places. I think this maybe is kind of like an example of that. But what do you see the role of trade policies in supporting and encouraging our farmers to grow the right kind of food?
Well, part of it is to make sure that they are treated equitably. There are some markets that we have difficulty securing access to. The sort of the policies of the Trump administration with their drive-by tariffs puts agricultural producers at risk, and it's not just soybeans. It's a problem in terms of the fruits that are exported from Oregon, for instance. But there are other issues that deeply concern me. One of them has to do with the integrity of organic foods. We're watching significant portions of organic blackberries being imported from Europe.
Yeah.
With candidly, I think, little evidence that the strict organic standards that we employ in the United States mostly. Now, there's some questions, as you know, about how some of the organic milk, is it really beat the standards? But I have grave questions about things that are being produced in Eastern Europe, for instance, in vast quantities meet our standards. And that's an area that I plan on investigating with the subcommittee, being able to make sure that our American farmers that do follow the rules have a chance to be able to make their case, and that we have stronger standards to protect the consumer.
One of the things I wanted to ask earlier about is I covered recently the renewable fuel standard, which is, I'm sure you can agree, the sexiest of policy issues out there today. But, you mentioned that people in Oregon are, are in Iowa are kind of starting to realize that a lot of these current ag policies aren't serving them. And certainly when I think about corn and ethanol, I think about Iowa. So I'm wondering if you have a stance on where we need to go from here. It seems to be an issue that so far a lot of the Democratic presidential hopefuls for 2020 are shying away, from saying that it needs reform.
Yeah. Well, as a practical matter, there's real question whether or not these fuels actually reduce.
They don't.
that they produce as much energy as they save.
Yeah, yeah.
And we have so much of our agricultural production diverted to something that we just burn up, and it poses problems in states like Iowa, because that is part of what makes the overall productivity decline. There's a dead zone in the mouth of the Mississippi River, the size of Delaware. It weakens soil health, producing using more chemical inputs, and moving away from higher value agricultural products that are not as hard on the environment. And it is indeed a heavy subsidy. That is not, in my judgment, the best way to help farmers in Iowa or any place else. Being able to get our policies right to support regenerative, sustainable agriculture, be able to stop subsidizing the industrial production of corn, and instead promote conservation and the development of food, research, marketing, things that will add value to farmers in Iowa and around the country, rather than the monocrop, production of a single, both corn and soybeans, by the way. I think there's that model is not going to be sustainable in the future, and it makes small and medium-sized farmers at the mercy of large industrial production.
Mm-hmm. So I'm from Brooklyn, where we're broadcasting, and my representatives are very much in line, I'll say, with my own political values. And one of the things I found frustrating, especially during the during any election, is the fact that I don't really know how, let's say, to get involved in issues where I disagree with other people's elected representatives, right? Like during the election, I think everyone who is experienced in politics was like, don't call senators that aren't your own, for instance. So how can somebody like me, who's thankfully represented by people who, whose values and priorities are in line with my own, get involved and help try to move the needle on these issues in areas where I'm not?
Well, I think first and foremost, everybody has a stake in getting these policies right. Food and farm, it doesn't just have to be somebody who's in one of the 30 districts that have heavy agricultural production. You're watching in metropolitan New York, indeed in Brooklyn, there are new methods in terms of urban agriculture, small farms, what's going to happen with hydroponic production. The food scene in Brooklyn is pretty powerful. We've put together a booklet. We call it The Fight for Food. People can go to earlblumenauer.com and be able to find a way to get a hold of a copy of it, where it's an illustrated guide about how these pieces fit together. There's no reason that people can't start, frankly, in Brooklyn and make sure that this is an issue for each of your members of Congress and people who are running for it. Mm-hmm. Dealing with nutrition, dealing with conservation, dealing with climate change and agriculture is a powerful element in our future, and it doesn't come up in most campaigns.
Yeah.
Well, you can change that. It is in the presidential election. I am hopeful that when we've got, 50 Democrats running for president, that there's an opportunity for people to use the tools of social media and what's going on around the country in terms of how people are going to distinguish. And a number of these people are friends of mine. I think they've got some great ideas. Elizabeth Warren, by the way, mm-hmm. Has some excellent ideas about farm policy. Well, they all should have that. So look at what Elizabeth Warren's put out, but mm-hmm. ask Beto, ask Joe Biden. I mean, Kamala Harris. I mean, all of these people need to be focused on food and farm policy. They're all not going to win in Iowa, and being able to stand firm for family farms and ranches, being able to stand firm for sustainability, for the nutrition needs of Americans. And by the way, in New Hampshire, they are cheated by the Farm Bill. So, you know, why shouldn't that be a bigger issue there?
Right. All right. Well, we have to leave it there. Representative Blumenauer, thank you so much for coming on. And it was a pleasure talking to you. And thank you for being such a champion for food system reform.
Well, I enjoy the conversation and look forward to continuing this with you and,
absolutely,
and your listeners.
Absolutely.
Because it's not going to be less important going forward.
Definitely. And then one more time, where can people go for more information that you've put out and to follow your work in continuing to champion for a better food and farm bill?
We have the Fight for Food available through my website, earlblumenauer.com. There's also material available in my official congressional website. And I invite people to dive in.
Great. All right. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as our engineer, Jeet Paul. Show music is by Tim Archer. All of the Eating Matters episodes are available on Heritage's website or as a podcast, wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liut, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter, @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.